This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of tibial plafond fractures from the trauma section on orthobullets.com. Let's start this episode with a quick summary. A tibial plafond fracture, also known as a pilon fracture, is a fracture of the distal end of the tibia, most commonly associated with comminution, intra-articular extension, and significant soft tissue injury. Diagnosis is typically made through clinical evaluation and confirmed with plain radiographs. Treatment is generally operative with temporary external fixation followed by delayed open reduction internal fixation once the soft tissues permit. Now, let's get into the episode. With respect to epidemiology, as far as incidence of tibia plafond fractures, these injuries are relatively common, making up 5 to 10% of all tibia fractures, however, account for less than 10% of lower extremity injuries. Note that the incidence is increasing as survival rates after motor vehicle collisions have increased. In terms of the demographics of tibial plafond fractures, the average patient age is 35 to 45 years old, and males are more affected than females. Moving on to the etiology, in terms of pathophysiology, the mechanism can be secondary to a high-energy axial load, which is the most common, or low-energy rotational forces, which are less common. In terms of high-energy axial load, note that the talus is driven into the plafond, resulting in articular impaction of the distal tibia. This can be secondary to falls from a height or from motor vehicle accidents. Low-energy rotational forces can be secondary to activities such as alpine skiing. In terms of pathoanatomy, note that the fracture patterns and comminution are determined by the position of the foot, amplitude of force, and the direction of force. This can lead to articular impaction and comminution, metaphyseal bone comminution, and note that three fragments are typical with intact ankle ligaments. That is the medial malleolar from the deltoid ligament, the posterolateral / Volkmann fragment, and the intact ligament is the posterior inferior tibiofibular ligament, and finally the anterolateral / Chaput fragment, and the intact ligament is the anterior inferior tibiofibular ligament. As far as associated conditions with tibial plafond fractures, note that 75% have associated fibular fractures, 30% have an ipsilateral lower extremity injury, 20% are open fractures, and 5 to 10% are bilateral pilon fractures. Now let's go over some relevant anatomy. We'll go over osteology and ligaments. So in terms of the osteology of the tibia, note that the distal tibia forms an inferior quadrilateral surface and pyramid-shaped medial malleolus, which articulates with the talus and fibula laterally via the fibular notch. The ligaments to know include the distal tibiofibular syndesmosis, which includes the anterior inferior tibiofibular ligament, or AITFL, posterior inferior tibiofibular ligament, or PITFL, the interosseous membrane, the interosseous ligament, and the inferior transverse ligament. So the anterior inferior tibiofibular ligament, or AITFL, originates from the anterolateral tubercle of the tibia, and this portion is referred to as the Chaput fragment. The anterior inferior tibiofibular ligament inserts onto the anterior tubercle of the fibula, and this portion is known as the Wagstaff fragment. Moving on to the posterior inferior tibiofibular ligament, this originates from the posterior tubercle of the tibia, which is known as the Volkmann fragment. The posterior inferior tibiofibular ligament inserts on the posterior part of the lateral malleolus and is the strongest component of the syndesmosis. Finally, the interosseous ligament is the distal continuation of the interosseous membrane. Now, let's go over the classification of tibial plafond fractures, and the ones to know include the AO/OTA classification and the Rudy-Algauer classification. So tibial plafond fractures in the AO/OTA classification refers to region 43, and this is divided into three types: 43A, 43B, and 43C. 43A is extra-articular, 43B is partial articular, and 43C is complete articular. Moving on to the Rudy-Algauer classification, this is divided into three types. Type 1 is non-displaced, type 2 corresponds to simple displacement with an incongruous joint, and type 3 corresponds to a comminuted articular surface. Moving on to the presentation of a tibial plafond fracture, symptoms include severe ankle pain, ankle deformity, and inability to bear weight. Physical exams should include inspection and palpation, motion assessment, and neurovascular evaluation. So inspection and palpation may reveal ankle tenderness, swelling, abrasions, ecchymosis, fracture blisters, open wounds, and or chronic skin/vascular changes. Be sure to examine for associated musculoskeletal injuries. In terms of motion assessment, note that ankle motion will be limited in the setting of a tibial plafond fracture. Neurovascular evaluation should include checking DP and PT pulses and consider ABIs and CT angiography if clinically warranted. Also look for neurologic compromise and check for signs/symptoms of compartment syndrome. Moving on to imaging, recommended views on radiographs include an AP, lateral, and a mortise. Know that full-length tibia/fibula and foot x-rays are performed for fracture extension, and lumbar film should be obtained if appropriate based on exam. Findings on radiographs include the four classic fracture fragments, which include the medial malleolus, the anterior malleolus or the Chaput fragment, the lateral malleolus or the Wagstaff fragment, and the posterior malleolus or the Volkmann fragment. Moving on to CT scan, as far as indications, a CT scan is critical for preoperative planning and can evaluate articular involvement, metaphyseal comminution, as well as fracture displacement. It's also important to obtain after a spanning external fixation as ligamentotaxis allows for better surgical planning. Finally, a CT scan will allow fine cuts through the distal tibia and know that 3D reconstructions can be helpful. Findings on CT scan include the Mercedes-Benz sign on the axials. As far as the diagnosis of tibial plafond fractures, this is clinical and radiographic. Know that plain radiographs are sufficient to make the diagnosis in conjunction with a CT scan for surgical planning. Treatment of tibial plafond fractures can be non-operative or operative. Non-operative management includes cast immobilization, which is indicated for stable fracture patterns without articular surface displacement, for critically ill or non-ambulatory patients, as well as in the setting of significant risk of skin problems such as diabetes, vascular disease, and or peripheral neuropathy. As far as outcomes, note that intra-articular fragments are unlikely to reduce with manipulation of displaced fractures. Know that loss of reduction is common, and remember that the inability to monitor soft tissue injuries is a major disadvantage of non-operative management. Operative options include temporizing spanning external fixation across the ankle joint, open reduction and internal fixation, external fixation / a circular frame fixation alone, intramedullary nailing with percutaneous screw fixation, and primary ankle arthrodesis. So the indications for a temporizing spanning external fixation across the ankle joint is for the acute management of most length unstable fractures. This provides stabilization to allow for soft tissue healing and monitoring, capsuloligamentotaxis to indirectly reduce the fracture by tensioning the soft tissues about the ankle. This option also keeps the fracture fragments out to length. Other indications include fractures with significant joint depression or displacement, and be sure to leave the temporizing spanning X-fix until swelling resolves, which is generally 10 to 14 days. Note that this option is not always warranted in length-stable pilon fractures. As far as outcomes, know that placement of the pins outside of the zone of injury and planned surgical site is important to reduce infection risks. Moving on to open reduction and internal fixation, indications include definitive fixation for a majority of pilon fractures. Know that limited or definitive ORIF can be performed acutely with low complications in certain situations. Outcomes are dependent on articular reduction, and know that there are high rates of wound complications and infections that are associated with early open fixation through compromised soft tissue. As far as the ability to drive, know that brake travel time returns to normal 6 weeks after weight bearing. Fibula fixation is not a necessary step in the reconstruction of pilon fractures, however, may be helpful in specific cases to aid in tibial plafond reduction or augment external fixation. Know that there are higher rates of fibula hardware removal in this setting. Moving on to external fixation / circular frame fixation alone, as far as indications, this is indicated in select cases where bone or soft tissue injury precludes internal fixation. As far as outcomes, know that thin wireframes and hybrid fixators have a high union rate. However, know that there is a high rate of pin tract infections. Osteomyelitis and deep infection are rare. A meta-analysis comparing this method with open reduction and internal fixation found no difference in infection or complication rates between the two groups. Moving on to intramedullary nailing with percutaneous screw fixation, this is an alternative to ORIF for fractures with a simple intra-articular component. As far as outcomes, this option minimizes soft tissue stripping and is useful in patients with soft tissue compromise. This option does have high union rates, however, there is an increased valgus malunion and recurvatum seen with intramedullary nailing compared to plate osteosynthesis. Finally, moving on to primary ankle arthrodesis, this has no definitive indications. Potential indications include severely comminuted injuries as well as non-reconstructable plafond fractures. Other potential indications include select elderly populations who cannot tolerate multiple surgeries or prolonged immobilization. It's also potentially indicated in manual laborers. The techniques involve plate and screw fixation, as well as retrograde intramedullary tibio-talo-calcaneal or TTC nail. As far as outcomes, a primary ankle arthrodesis is theorized to have a quicker recovery process and decreased long-term pain. However, this increases the risk of adjacent joint arthritis, including the subtalar joint and midfoot. Now, let's talk about some of these management techniques in a bit more detail. So as far as cast immobilization, the technique will be a long leg cast for 6 weeks followed by fracture brace and range of motion exercises. Note that close follow-up and imaging is needed to ensure articular congruity and axial alignment. Moving on to external fixation, which can be temporary and definitive. As far as the technique, fixator constructs vary, with delta and A-frame assemblies being the most common. Note that there are two tibial shaft half pins outside the zone of injury connected to a single transcalcaneal pin. Be sure to consider transnavicular pins if associated with a calcaneal fracture. Also consider connecting the fixator to the forefoot first metatarsal to prevent an equinus contracture. Another potential technique is a joint-spanning articulated versus non-spanning hybrid ring. Note that none have been shown to be superior with respect to ankle stiffness. Finally, remember that you can combine external fixation with a limited percutaneous fixation using lag screws. Complications include pin side drainage, pin slash wire tract infections, pin side fracture, ankle stiffness, injury to neurovascular structures, and remember that anatomic articular reconstruction may not be possible, especially with central depression. Moving on to circular frame fixation, as far as the technique, know that distraction is the key to reduction. In terms of proximal fixation, the tibial shaft is used as a fixation base to reduce the fracture. Two half pins in the AP plane are placed with rings in an orthogonal position. This is used to support the distal fixation rings. In terms of distal fixation, this is determined by the configuration of the fracture and the soft tissue injury. The rings are placed at the level of the plafond or calcaneus to distract and reduce the fracture. Pins should be placed at least 1 to 2 centimeters from the joint line in order to avoid possible septic arthritis. Know that the safe zones for wire placement form a 60-degree arc in the medial lateral plane. Finally, circular frame fixation can include limited internal fixation if the soft tissue permits. You can consider the need for soft tissue coverage with the position of the fixator. Finally, hydroxyapatite-coated pins provide better fixation and decreases the frequency of loosening. Moving on to open reduction and rigid internal fixation, timing to definitive surgery is based on when skin wrinkles are present, blister epithelialization is complete, and ecchymosis resolution in 10 to 14 days. As far as approach or approaches, know that single or multiple incisions are based on the fracture pattern and goals of fixation. Be sure to keep a full thickness skin bridge greater than 7 centimeters between incisions. Know that positioning of the patient is dependent on approach or approaches being utilized. You can use the direct anterior approach to the ankle and the anterolateral approach to the ankle. This is useful with fractures impacted in valgus or with an intact fibula. This puts the deep peroneal nerve at risk during exposure and dissection in the anterior compartment. Know that the superficial peroneal nerve is at risk during superficial dissection in the lateral compartment. Other approaches include the anteromedial approach to the ankle, the medial approach, the posterior medial approach, the posterior lateral approach, and the lateral approach. As far as the technique, in terms of reduction and fixation, the goal is for anatomic reduction of the articular surface. Location of plate slash screws are fracture and soft tissue dependent. Be sure to restore alignment with a goal of less than 5 to 10 degrees of varus slash valgus and less than 5 to 10 degrees procurvatum slash recurvatum. Be sure to restore length and consider provisionally leaving the external fixator in place. You should also reconstruct the metaphyseal shell. You can use bone graft if warranted, reattach the metaphysis to the diaphysis, and you can fix the fibula if needed, which can be with intramedullary screws slash wires or a plate slash screw construct. With respect to postoperative care, ankle range of motion exercises begin at 2 weeks post-op. Patients will be non-weight bearing for approximately 6 to 12 weeks, depending on the radiographic evidence of fracture consolidation. Moving on to primary ankle arthrodesis, the approach will be a direct anterior approach. The technique can involve plate and screw fixation, or a tibio-talo-calcaneal or TTC fusion with retrograde intramedullary nail. In terms of plate and screw fixation, first be sure to debride fibrous tissue, fracture callus, and cartilage. Small comminuted articular fragments are then removed. You will then remove the Taylor dome cartilage and pack the metaphyseal defects and the tibio-talar joint with autologous or allograft bone graft. This can include iliac crest or demineralized bone matrix. The optimal position will be neutral dorsiflexion, 5 to 10 degrees of external rotation, 5 degrees of hindfoot valgus, and 5 millimeters of posterior Taylor translation. Fixation will be done with an anterior plate and screw construct. Postoperative care includes applying a cast or splint for 8 weeks, progress weight bearing between 8 and 12 weeks in a removable boot, full weight bearing with an ankle brace at 12 weeks post-op, and a CT scan at 3 months to assess for successful fusion. tibiotalocalcaneal or TTC fusion with a retrograde intramedullary nail sacrifices subtalar joint motion, however, accelerates transverse tarsal joint motion. Also keep in mind that this option permits immediate weight bearing. Moving on to complications of tibial plafond fractures, the ones to know include wound slough and dehiscence, infection, malunion, nonunion, post-traumatic arthritis, chondrolysis, and stiffness. So starting with wound slough and dehiscence, the incidence is 9 to 30%. Be sure to wait for soft tissue edema to subside before ORAF, which can be between 1 to 2 weeks. Treatment for a wound slough and dehiscence includes a free flap for postoperative wound breakdown. Infection has an incidence of 5 to 15%. Risk factors include significant soft tissue swelling at the time of definitive surgery. Treatment includes irrigation and debridement, antibiotics, and possible hardware removal. Moving on to malunion, this has an incidence of 6 to 14%. Treatment includes joint preserving correction with secondary anatomic reconstruction, as well as corrective ankle fusion. Moving on to nonunion, the incidence is 5% of patients undergoing RIF. Know that nonunion usually takes place at the metaphyseal junction. Risk factors include metaphyseal comminution, open fractures, bone loss, tobacco use, and NSAID use. As far as treatment, know that you must rule out infected nonunion. Labs to obtain include a CRP, ESR, and white blood cell count. Other nonunion labs include PTH, calcium, total protein, serum albumin, vitamin D, and TSH. As far as treatment for a nonunion, this includes rigid fixation with bone grafting. Finally, moving on to post-traumatic arthritis, know that chondrocyte cell death at the fracture margins is a contributing factor. IL-6 is elevated in the synovial fluid following an intra-articular ankle fracture. Know that post-traumatic arthritis most commonly begins 1 to 2 years post-injury. Risk factors include sequela of cartilage trauma, non-anatomic articular reduction, and/or malalignment. As far as treatment, first line is conservative management like bracing, injections, NSAIDs, and activity modification, and surgical options include total ankle arthroplasty and ankle arthrodesis. Now, let's end this review session talking about prognosis of tibial plafond fractures. Know that poor outcomes and lower return to work is associated with lower level of education, pre-existing medical comorbidities, male sex, work-related injuries, and lower income levels. Know that outcomes correlate with the severity of the fracture pattern and the quality of reduction. At two-year follow-up, the majority of type C pilon fractures report lower SF36 scores than patients with pelvic fractures, AIDS, or coronary artery disease. Clinical improvement is seen for up to 2 years after the injury. In terms of return of vehicle braking response time, this occurs 6 weeks after initiation of weight bearing. Okay, so now that we've gone over the major points about this topic, let's go over a few questions to apply the information and get a sense of how this topic might be tested. First question. Which of the following statements is true regarding brake travel time after surgical treatment of complex lower extremity trauma? And the choices are 1, brake travel time is significantly increased until 6 weeks after the patient begins weight bearing. 2, return of normal brake time takes longer after long bone fracture compared to articular fractures. 3, normal brake travel time correlates with improved short musculoskeletal functional assessment scores. 4, brake travel time is significantly reduced until 8 weeks after the patient begins weight bearing. And 5, brake travel time returns to normal when weight bearing begins. The correct answer to this question is 1, brake travel time is significantly increased until 6 weeks after the patient begins weight bearing. So brake travel time has been shown to be significantly increased until 6 weeks after initiation of weight bearing in both long bone and articular fractures of the right lower extremity. Eagle et al. Used a computerized driving simulator to compare brake travel time in 3 groups of patients. 1, the control group, 2, long bone lower extremity fracture group, and 3, lower extremity articular fracture group. They concluded that brake travel time was significantly increased until 6 weeks after initiation of weight bearing in both long bone and articular fractures of the right lower extremity, and that short musculoskeletal functional assessment scores improved with respect to function and other indexes, but did not correlate with improvement in brake travel time. An earlier study by Eagle et al. Looked at total brake time as it related to distance traveled by the automobile before braking at 6, 9, and 12 weeks after operative fixation of a right ankle fracture. When compared with controls, braking time was shown to return to normal by 9 weeks postoperatively, and no significant association was found between the functional scores and this normalization. And moving on to the final question. In a pilon fracture, the chaput fragment typically maintains soft tissue attachment via which of the following structures? and the choices are 1. Interosseous ligament, 2. Anterior inferior tibiofibular ligament, 3. Posterior inferior tibiofibular ligament, 4. Deltoid ligament, and 5. Tibio-Taylor ligament. The correct answer to this question is 2. Anterior inferior tibiofibular ligament. So the Chaput fragment is the anterolateral fragment of the distal tibia. This section of bone attaches to the anterior inferior tibiofibular ligament and is often hinged off this structure due to the fracture. A pilon fracture is often split into 3 main fragments at the joint level, that is the Chaput fragment anterolaterally, the Volkmann fragment posterolaterally, and a medial fragment. The Volkmann fragment is the attachment site of the posterior inferior tibiofibular ligament. The Wagstaff fragment is the fibular corollary to the Chaput fragment and serves as the other attachment of the anterior inferior tibiofibular ligament. That's all for this review about tibial plafond fractures. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. Keep in mind that these podcasts are designed to go along with the topics on orthobullets.com, and in fact, you can listen to these episodes right on the OrthoBullets website or mobile app while going through the topic. If you've gotten any value from the OrthoBullets podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Also, if you aren't already, be sure to follow OrthoBullets on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube for daily high-yield content. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you all tomorrow, right here on the OrthoBullets podcast.